One of the great leaders of the Old Testament is the prophet Elijah. We remember the story beginning at 1 Kings chapter 17, where Elijah is summoned by God to go before the nation Israel, the northern kingdom, and to announce to that nation that God's judgment is upon it and that there will be no rain and there will be no crops until the announcement is made through Elijah. Elijah then is sent east of the Jordan River to the brook Cherith. You remember where he is fed by the ravens and so on from the scraps. And then when that little brook dries up, he is sent up north and west to a city in Sidon, which just happens to be Jezebel's home turf. And there he is directed to the home of a widow who is virtually at the point of starvation. And you remember, as she ministers to Elijah the prophet, she and her son survive because God never allows the oil or the grain to run out. Elijah, after a period of time, is sent by God to confront Ahab the king. And you remember in that confrontation that Elijah challenges the false prophets of Israel to a contest on Mount Carmel. The false prophets are challenged to have a sacrifice which they call upon their gods to ignite, and it doesn't happen. Elijah then builds the altar. He has it flooded with water multiple times, and then he prays to God, and God ignites it in such a way that everything is consumed, including the water. Elijah then announces to the king that he is to hurry home because the rains are about to come. You remember that Elijah girds up his loins and he actually arrives in Jezreel ahead of King Ahab. King Ahab goes immediately to his wife Jezebel and reports the story. And rather than surrender, rather than God to take her out, as perhaps Elijah had hoped, Jezebel utters a threat that she is going to have his head. He will not live, for she has determined that he will die. And you remember that Elijah then tries to turn in his prophet's badge. He leaves his servant behind, he heads for the wilderness, and he pleads with God to take his life. Elijah, the great prophet, is now suicidal, and he wants to resign from his ministry. He is depressed, he is discouraged, he feels defeated, and he wants to quit. That's an ancient story, but unfortunately it reflects the reality of what is happening in many churches and with many church leaders today. There is a set of statistics that is given to us in the book Replenish that is the result of a study that was taken by several groups regarding the well-being and the attitude of those who are pastors. Here are some of the results. 80% of the pastors and 85% of their spouses feel discouraged in the roles that they have. 70% of the pastors feel isolated and alone and have no friend in which they can confide, no confidant, no mentor. 71% of the pastors stated they were burned out and battled depression on a consistent and regular basis. 1,500 pastors every month permanently leave the ministry because of such matters. That's a very, very sad set of statistics. But my point is, what we find with Elijah is what we find with many leaders in the church today. So what we need to do is to learn from God's dealing with Elijah what one factor is in the solution to those dilemmas. And it is the factor of shared leadership. I find it interesting to note what Elijah's description and evaluation of his ministry is. He says, in effect, I have failed. Not only have I failed, but Israel has failed, and there is no hope. But the key statement I want to land on is the statement that he makes at least three times, I alone am left. Now, we know that's not the reality. And I've often said, a man who has tears in his eyes cannot see things very clearly. And this is such a case with Elijah. We know, for example, from God's words to Elijah, there are 7,000 Israelites who have not bowed the knee to Baal. Elijah is not alone, and all Israel has not turned from God. There is indeed a remnant. Elijah seems to say as well that he is alone as a prophet. He is the last hope for Israel. There are no others. And since he has failed, there are no others that can do the job. Israel is doomed. It's all over. You remember, however, that there were 100 prophets who had been hidden away. Elijah was not the only prophet. He was one of 100, if not more, prophets that were still there. Elijah was wrong. His discouragement and depression was ill-founded. But what I want to focus on is what God does to deal with that discouragement and depression. And in particular, what God does to deal with that sense of isolation and aloneness that really is characteristic of Elijah at this moment in his life. You remember that there were actually three things that he did, but the most significant one for our discussion is this. He says to him that he is to go and he is to appoint Elisha as his successor. He is to name him. I think early on in my years of ministry, I thought this was something that happened very late in Elijah's ministry. I've now come to the conclusion that it's something that happened rather early in his ministry. And Elisha was a man who teamed up with him and was with him for, it seems, a number of years before Elijah is taken up into heaven and Elisha carries on his task. But what I am talking about here is shared leadership. The New Testament does not talk about lone ranger leaders. It does not talk about one man at the top other than our Lord Jesus and a succession of authority figures who flow below. The New Testament talks about leadership in the sense of a group of men who share leadership together. You see that in the fact that elders are almost always discussed in a plural way rather than in a singular way. Even churches that must have been relatively small, like the church at Philippi, had elders, plural, and deacons. Leadership was that which was shared amongst a group of men, not the sole possession of any one person, except, of course, that of our Lord Jesus Christ. So our Lord meets this depressed prophet as the angel of the Lord. He feeds him, he sends him off, and he commissions him to have a man who is his co-laborer who will minister with him. And I think there's many benefits to that. And that's the way it is in the Old Testament and the New. Leadership, ideally, is shared leadership. Think about it. Moses is overwhelmed with leading this stiff-necked people, and surely they were that. What does God do? He appoints 70 men and empowers them to labor, as it were, to share the load of leadership that Moses alone had borne. Moses had Joshua, who was with him, and eventually a man who would succeed him as a leader of the nation Israel. When Paul goes about his ministry, he always goes about that ministry with a team. He is always cast in a set of men with a variety of gifts and ministries. There is a pluralistic team element to the ministry of the Apostle Paul, and that surely is the case in the church as well. The church was never envisioned as a body that was governed by one man, but rather a body that was led by a plurality of men. Now, think about what advantages we have if that is the kind of leadership that we are developing. The burden of leadership is shared. You should not have then the Lone Ranger syndrome of Elijah in the wilderness. And when you have a multiplicity of leaders, you have a multiplicity of gifts. So that now leadership makes decisions and takes action based upon a diversity of perspectives and gifts that gives far more wisdom to what is decided and what is done. You also find that when ministry and leadership take place in a plural form, that not only do the plurality of leaders minister more effectively to others, they also minister to one another. A plurality of leaders creates a group of men who care for one another, who watch out for one another, who serve one another. That's a huge benefit, I think, in the area of ministry. And there's another benefit. When new ministries emerge, or when new opportunities come along, or when God leads a leader in a church onto another ministry, there are others to take his place. And we see that in Acts chapter 13, there was a plurality of men in ministry in that church. And when Paul and Barnabas were set aside, the ministry went on. Plurality leadership is God's kind of leadership, and it has many, many benefits. Now, what I would like to suggest to you is some ways in which our church has sought to implement this principle. Number one, we have plurality of leadership in terms of the relationship between elders and deacons. Not only do we have a plurality of elders, but we have deacons who assist the elders in that ministry. So there is a mutuality of focus. There is a camaraderie that takes place in that plural context. There also are in our church small groups, which we happen to call ministry groups. Other churches may call them other names, but they're just small groups. We have leaders who meet the qualifications for deacons. Our ministry group leaders are deacon leaders. And we're endeavoring in every instance to have co-leaders, not singular leaders, but to have mutual co-leaders who guide that group. So there is a plurality of leadership, not only in the broad sense of the church's leadership, but also in the context of ministry group leadership. One other area. One area that is often considered the turf of one man is the pulpit. In our church for 37, now going on 38 years, we've had what we call a preaching seminar. And when I was the active preacher there, in the week before the sermon, a group of men met to discuss the text for the coming week, to talk about its interpretation and its application. And I can tell you that is an invaluable thing for the preaching process, to have multiplicity of input, to have a plurality, a dimension to it, which most do not, as well as the possibility of talking about last week's sermon and perhaps where it went wrong or where it went right. But all of those are ways in which we in our church have sought to implement this concept of shared leadership, as opposed to leadership which gravitates toward one person and becomes their territory and their turf exclusively. And we believe that's God's way of developing leaders. So that when we look for men to be leaders, we look for men who think in terms of the team, not in terms of just themselves. To put it in musical terms, we want a choir. We don't want soloists who are off seeking their own spotlights. We want a choir of people who serve together. And the beauty of that unity and that mutuality is evident.